Welcome to Imagination Redeemed. This is Jane Charle, or JC Charle, and I am the series editor for the current creation theology series that we are running through the Anselm Society. This month, I contributed an essay about time, so I am here to read that essay for you today. What if time is more than the passing of moments? What if it's a gift to help us find meaning? And what if the Christian life, in which death itself starts working backwards, can change our experience of past, present, and future, grief and joy, memory and expectation? This chapter of our series explores the gift of time, a gift we will explore further in the Imagination Redeemed 2022 conference in September. Finding meaning in time. Imagine this, a person, a woman, on her knees, praying fervently. All her being is present in the prayer. Her body is poised as if to spring into action. Her face is fixed, though her eyes are closed. She is praying for a man, a relative of hers, who she knows is enduring brutal torments. He is being burned alive. She is praying for him, bringing all that she is to God to intercede for this man, that he might have joy and steadfast hope, that after all his tortures, he would see salvation. Now imagine that the man has been burned to death 400 years prior. Yet the woman prays, and her prayer ascends, and God hears, and 400 years before the prayer is said, it is answered. A soul is granted perseverance and is saved. This is a remarkable scene, but not for the reasons we may think. It is remarkable because prayer is remarkable, nothing else. For those who have considered truly the nature of the God to whom we pray, time makes as little difference as space. If we do not hesitate to pray for a fellow human separated from us by half the globe, we ought not hesitate to pray for someone separated from us by such a trivial thing as time. It may seem hubristic to call time a trivial thing. Few things have as much control over our day-to-day experiences as time. We even call the basic elements of our lives day-to-day. In other words, time mediates what we experience as the fabric of our lives. But let us follow that prayer upward. From the very instant, how all our language is ruled by time. It comes into being in the heart and see where it goes. The woman, you perhaps, or a friend of yours, sees or recalls or hears about some pain, some suffering elsewhere in this world. It seizes her and drives her to turn her mind towards God. The prayer begins as a voiceless cry. An inclining of the imagination toward the one and three. Perhaps, it seems possible, this is the highest form of prayer, a wordless longing, an instinctive turning of the spirit and the will to God. I do not know. She, at least, is not content with this. She goes into her room hastily, closes the door, and falls to her knees. She buries her face in her hands, clasped on the edge of the bed, and she begins to form thoughts, images, and finally words. She casts all these things desperately up and out, she knows not where. She prays for many minutes, 10, 20, moving through words to silence and back again to words. In the space of this prayer, she labors. She is in agony. And she offers up all the energy and attention that she has to her plea. At last, she is exhausted. She says, "Thy will be done," and leans back on her heels. The world presses in around her, time and space alike. She has to get dinner in the oven. Her prayer is done. But what do we mean, her prayer is done? Isn't it more likely that the prayer has just begun? That when the woman rises and goes about her day, attending to the tasks that demand her immediate attention, giving her love to the little things crowding around her, her prayer continues to resonate in eternity, calling out for the Almighty's ear. Now imagine 400 years before, the man burning in agony on the pyre cries out, begging for relief, for hope. Does not his cry too hang in eternity? So what do we call the instant in eternity, which does not consist of instants, where his cry meets her intercession? Full disclosure, I have not invented this scene. It is central to the novel Descent into Hell by Charles Williams, one of the lesser-known Inklings. Peter Kraft describes it as the most terrifying book he has ever read. Part of the terror comes from Williams' bold exploration of time as a cosmic instrument, like space, for salvation. Yet Williams' vision is less esoteric than it seems at first glance. C.S. Lewis tackles the same theme in the Narnia books, albeit less confrontationally. When Lucy first enters Narnia through the wardrobe, she spends hours and hours talking with Mr. Tumnus and returns convinced that her siblings will be out of their minds with worry about her. But it turns out that hours and hours in Narnia is no time at all in our world. Time, it seems, is less linear and less definite than we think. What Lewis evokes is the experience we have all had of eternity and time butting up against each other, one existing inside the other, as it were, all around us. Time is elastic in our personal experience, says the Italian physicist Carlo Rovelli. Think about a child at play. He is utterly absorbed in his task of building or stacking or sorting or whatever it is that has captured him, and to his mind, no time is passing at all. In fact, even that is too timely a statement. He has utterly left time. Re-entering it can come as a shock, at least for my children. The end of this kind of mystical playtime often comes with tears and frustration. No matter how long it has gone on, no matter what activity we have scheduled next, they feel eternity slipping out of their grasp, or conversely, they feel time closing in on them, and it breaks their hearts. We can call these conflicting experiences of time chronos, kairos, and the much less familiar aeon. These are named after the three Greek gods of time. Chronos is where we get our word chronological. Time is time moving along as moments on a clock, measurable, predictable, relentless. It just keeps marching, and we must march along with it or be left behind. Kairos time, however, is not measurable by clocks and stars. It is right time, or appropriate time. It is God's time. It is time in eternity, if you will, when the meaning of time itself becomes clear. Think of the gorgeous There is a Time passage from Ecclesiastes 3, one of the better bits of poetry humanity has ever written. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant, and a time to pluck up that which is planted. A time to kill, and a time to heal. A time to destroy, and a time to build. A time to weep, and a time to laugh. A time to mourn, and a time to dance. When the passage was translated from Hebrew to Greek, time was always translated as kairos. Kairos is eternity peering in through the windows of this little house we call Chronos, and beckoning. Finally, aeon, which gives us eon and eon, is eternity itself. The question of what time is has plagued us for millennia. Time, the medium in which we exist, the water of our sea, tortures us, but the very fact of that torture, the fact that our greatest minds have tried to unravel the mystery of time, tells us something interesting about our relationship with time. Water does not torment fish, and birds do not decry the winds for changing in the fall. Yet time, our atmosphere, is our greatest burden, and we pour countless resources, including time itself, into finding ways to control it. We are immersed in time, and it takes serious imaginative effort to get ourselves out of time, as it were, to think about it. Our experience of time is linear, barring those brief moments when we enter so fully into an activity or meditation that we escape it. We experience time as a line that we are traveling down. There are points behind us and points ahead of us. We cannot move ahead, no matter how much we might want to. And once we have passed a point, we cannot return to it. This is our experience of time. But increasingly, our observations of nature are revealing that time itself does not really work like this. Points in time, on a physical level, do not appear to be linear or fixed. Rather, they behave more like streams in the wilderness, which flow and shift, than like beads strung along a thread. Carlo Rovelli is a scientist. To be more precise, he is a theoretical physicist and one of the founders of the loop quantum gravity theory. Rovelli and his fellow theorists are trying to give a coherent account for the baffling observations physicists have made on the quantum or subatomic level. Rovelli acknowledges of loop quantum theory. Am I certain that this is the correct description of the world? I am not. But it is today the only coherent and complete way I know of to think of the structure of space-time without neglecting its quantum properties. In The Order of Time, Rovelli brings the scientific questions that plague physicists into conversation with philosophical and literary questions of meaning. Rovelli expounds on such staggering scientific theories as Einstein's idea that the present of the universe is meaningless, Rudolf Clausius's notion that time and heat are essentially related, and so time can only be measured in relation to heat, and Ludwig Boltzmann's disturbing claim that, quote, the difference between the past and the future refers only to our own blurred vision of the world, end quote. Rovelli argues from a scientific perspective that on a physical level, meaning a level that can be studied by physics, each of the characteristics we associate with time, unity of flow, direction of flow, and independence or measurability of flow, is an illusion. In other words, time as a physical aspect of the universe is nothing like our experience of it. Perhaps the easiest way to think about these different views and experiences of time is by thinking about light. Our experience of light is of a wave or a pool. When it is present, it flows everywhere until it hits an obstacle, like a wall. But when we study light on the smallest possible level, it is not always a wave. Instead, we find particles, tiny flecks of energy that interact with flecks of matter. What we experience when we see light is that interaction. Particles of white light hitting a brick wall, and certain particles absorbing into the wall while other certain particles bounce off and return to our eyes, communicating the color brick red to our corneas. Time, it seems, may be much more like light than we have previously thought. Rather than being a smoothly flowing line, it seems to be made up of a whole collection of interactions. What we call time is merely a description of the results of those interactions. As Rovelli says, time is roughly reducible to change. That is it. Recall that this is a scientific view of time. Rovelli is writing about what happens to time at a micro level. Knowing all this does not fundamentally alter how we live our lives, at least not yet, but it does shift the balance a bit. It forces us to think of time and differences in time as existing in much the same way as space. Whereas humans have long thought of time as a linear, fluid thing, and space as a multidimensional, more or less static thing, it seems that on a very, very small level, time and space are much more similar than that. They seem to both be multidimensional and fluid. Linearity and stability are both illusions of scale. Now, why does any of this matter? Surely none of us are going to start living as if time wasn't linear, After all, we all know that at one end of our lives we are born, and at the other end we die. Everything that happens in between is our life. We cannot move backward or, except at one fixed speed, forward. If that isn't linear, what is? The linearity of our experience of time is certainly real. Even Christ submitted to the experience of time as a linear progression. He was born, he lived, he died. Then he rose again, of course, but his life and death honored and indwelt the sequence of cause and effect that we call time, which God set in motion at the creation. But submitting to time as an experience of linear progression is not the same thing as being trapped within a time that is only ever a linear progression. In the second scenario, we have no choice. Our environment is crushing us and there's nothing we can do. In the first, we have the opportunity to recognize the medium of time as a means of grace. Time is much less of a linear progression than it seems. Rather, it is a landscape in which we wander. Just as a mountain does not disappear when we can no longer see it, moments do not disappear once we are no longer living them. The phenomenological difference between time and space is that we all seem to inhabit one moment of time together, whereas we are all in different spaces. But could it be that we only seem to share a moment in time, and in reality, time is far less fixed than we think? St. Catherine of Siena is said to have written that all the road to heaven is heaven. She meant that to the soul completely fixed on heaven, everything in this temporal life reveals God's love, the love that is heaven. But if this is true, if we can, in this life, be in heaven even occasionally, are we not transcending our usual linear experience of time? Are we not punctuating time, the life lived on earth, with non-time, with supra-time, with eternity? Here is an example of what I mean. Within the Catholic faith, the moment within the Mass where the priest offers the Eucharist to God is eternity. In that moment, the faithful who are present pass outside Chronos time into Kairos time. We are no longer, in a metaphysical sense, embedded in the passing of moments and hours. Instead, we have entered a mode of time in which Jesus, as the sacrificial lamb, is pleading constantly, interceding before God for our souls. Catholics do not believe that Christ is again placed upon the cross at every single Mass. Rather, we believe that Christ's sacrifice on the cross occurred in both Chronos time and in Kairos time. It punched through, as it were, the boundary between modes of time, and now all our times are held together by Jesus. The motto of the Carthusian order of monks, Stat crux dom volvitur orbis, the cross is still while all the earth is moving. Moving through space, yes, but also through time. In other words, once time is not a regimented, mechanical thing for us, but a conglomeration of consequential experiences and relations, we can live differently. We need not fear time and its passing. Rather, we can see the passing of time as a means of knowing grace, of coming to know God in a unique and dear way. Ravelli may be a scientist, but he writes like a poet. He addresses this conundrum quite beautifully, weaving scientific terminology and poetry together, saying, "The elementary particles do not exist immersed in space. Rather, they themselves form that space. The spatiality of the world consists of the web of their interactions. They do not dwell in time. They interact incessantly with each other, and indeed exist only in terms of this incessant interaction. And this interaction is the happening of the world. It is the minimum elementary form of time that is neither directional nor linear. It is a reciprocal interaction in which quanta manifest themselves in the interaction in relation to what they interact with." Here I invite you to return to what we know about God. That God is what exists beyond all else. That God is three in one, triune, and all that exists flows from the interactions between the three persons of God. In the beginning, God creates, and he speaks within and amongst himself. Let us make man in our image. At the baptism of Jesus, all three persons appear to our senses: Christ the Son, the Dove the Spirit, and the Voice the Father. Baptism in the mind of the Church is an act of cleansing and rebirth, an act of creation. All that we have comes to us through the interactions of the three persons of God. 2 Corinthians 5:17 says, "Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old has gone, the new has come." There is a more excellent way than the clinical word interactions for talking about the relationships between the divine persons, the word love. Join me in a flight of imagination. Let us replace the word interactions in Ravelli's passage with this word love. Listen to this quantum physicist saying that at the lowest level, the level we cannot yet even see but can only observe from a reverent distance, there are things that do not exist immersed in space. Rather, they themselves form that space. The spatiality of the world consists of the web of their love. They do not dwell in time. They incessantly love each other, and indeed exist only in terms of this incessant love. And this love is the happening of the world. It is the minimum elementary form of time that is neither directional nor linear. Most astonishingly, Ravelli is speaking about a reciprocal love in which quanta manifest themselves in love in relation to what they love. Perhaps at this point you're beginning to think, this is crazy, or worse, this sounds like mysticism. In either case, you'd be right. Reality is crazy, crazier and more wonderful by far than we can begin to imagine. Mystical theology is the sane response to the wonder of the created order. And Ravelli, a bona fide scientist, might agree with me. Elsewhere in The Order of Time, he writes this poignant passage. As human beings, we live by emotions and thoughts. We exchange them when we are in the same place at the same time, talking to each other, looking into each other's eyes, brushing against each other's skin. We are nourished by this network of encounters and exchanges. But in reality, we do not need to be in the same place and time to have such exchanges. Thoughts and emotions that create bonds of attachment between us have no difficulty in crossing seas and decades, sometimes even centuries, tied to thin sheets of paper or dancing between the microchips of a computer. What Ravelli says is objectively true. By material means like paper or microchips, we routinely overstep space and time to speak to each other. That in itself is marvelous, that we, creatures of dust, submerged in time, can transcend time and space constantly and speak to other souls far removed from us in the landscape of space and time. It leaves a question unanswered, though. Can we, as Christians, create these bonds even without paper or computers, but solely through the action of an exchange that we call prayer? Can we slip, even erratically and unsustainably, beyond the bounds of time into a mode of existence that is not bound to follow the causal unfolding that we call time? A mode we call by the beautiful name eternity. Of course we can. In fact, we must. In his final book, Letters to Malcolm, C.S. Lewis probes the relationship between time and prayer, and I am not aware of a better summary than his. Our prayers are granted, or not, in eternity. Our prayers and other free acts are known to us only as we come to the moment of doing them, but they are eternally in the score of the great symphony. Not predetermined. The syllable pre lets in the notion of eternity as simply an older time. For though we cannot experience our life as an endless present, we are eternal in God's eyes, that is, in our deepest reality. When I say we are in time, I don't mean that we are impossibly outside the endless present in which he beholds us as he beholds all else. I mean, our creaturely limitation is that our fundamentally timeless reality can be experienced by us only in the mode of succession. What effect on our day-to-day existence, then, comes from being eternal in God's eyes? I am no saint. I am no mystic. I myself have only glimpsed the hills and valleys of the land of salvation through the eyes of others. Williams, Ravelli, St. Catherine, Lewis, and many more. I myself cannot say that I roam these hills freely, but from what I have seen, roaming these hills is far more possible than we may be inclined to believe. When we think of time in this way, our approach to prayer is transformed. If time is not merely a straight line which we ride for a while before falling off, but in its fullness a broad, dynamic landscape, if time is much more like eternity than we experience it to be, then we have a great deal more freedom in how we pray. We need not confine ourselves to praying for the future. Indeed, we can pray for the past, and we can rest assured that our prayers are heard and granted in eternity where God is. For example, suppose that someone we love has died, and we are not happy with the relationship we had with that person. If time is much less of a line and more of a landscape, we can truly and faithfully pray for our past relationship. We can beg that God was working in that relationship beyond what we knew, and we can look forward to experiencing the answer to those prayers in eternity. All this vision of time as a landscape rather than a line, also has the power to transform how we live within time. The devil has managed to turn time into a double-edged sword, slicing at us with nostalgia or regret over the past and poisoning us with dread or abstract ambitions about the future, and distracting us entirely from the present, our nearest analogy to the experience of eternity. But once we conceive of time as a landscape, the devil loses many of his weapons. We have access to something greater than the tension between living life backwards, facing the past, or forwards, straining into the future. We know that both are safe in eternity. Both will be perfectly redeemed. As T.S. Eliot writes in the Four Quartets, time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future, and time future contained in time past. All time is eternally present. This allows us to truly love. The biggest distractions from love are past perceived wrongs and losses, or future abstractions. We cannot love a person truly if we are fixated either on the past or on the future. Acts of love can only be done in the present. Nowhere is this clearer than in the life of the Lord Jesus. He is always deeply present. Whether with his disciples, his mother, Pontius Pilate, or the penitent thief on the cross, he is immediately and urgently with them. In the few moments where his mind goes to the suffering before him, there is a clear reason in the present for it. He takes his awareness of the future and, rather than letting it cripple him, transforms it into a parable or a prayer, which he then gives as a gift. For Jesus, no moment is only Chronos. Every moment on earth is Chronos and Kairos, perfectly integrated. Every moment for Jesus is the right moment. This, in turn, has the power to allow us to live in faith that every moment of our lives is being saved up for us as an eternal means of grace. All the road to heaven is heaven. This is what I believe it means to be saved. Salvation is nothing less than a union with God so perfect that we recognize all the moments of our lives as gifts, gifts of grace, opportunities to be with God. Lewis puts it this way in The Great Divorce, when George MacDonald says to the narrator, "Not only this valley, but all their earthly past will have been heaven to those who are saved. They don't know that heaven, once attained, will work backwards and turn even that agony into a glory. The process begins even before death. The good man's past begins to change so that his forgiving sins and remembered sorrows take on the quality of heaven. And that is why, at the end of all things, when the sun rises here, the blessed will say, 'We have never lived anywhere except in heaven.'"